This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Inflation matters, people. That is all I am going to say. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Thursday today, the 10th of October. Good as always to have you along, everybody. We say all the time on this program that you can spout headline economic indicators until you are blue in the face. But it's what people are feeling in their economic day-to-day that really matters. And today, we can quantify what people are feeling in their economic day-to-day. This morning, as it does around this time every year, the Social Security Administration announced its cost of living adjustments. 1.6% is the bump that about 70 million retirees are going to get starting in January. But as Marketplace's Sabri Benishour reports, for a lot of seniors, that adjustment and the way it's calculated doesn't reflect their reality.
When the Social Security Administration figures out how much more expensive life is getting for seniors, it uses data from not seniors.
It's based on the Consumer Price Index for urban wage earners and clerical workers.
Mary Johnson is a Social Security policy analyst with the Senior Citizens League, an advocacy group.
In other words, for younger working adults.
Younger working adults do not spend the same way that seniors do.
Seniors simply use more health care. We all will as we age.
Webster Phillips is with the National Committee to Preserve Social Security and Medicare. Healthcare costs have been rising more than twice as fast as everything else.
So if that's left out of the calculus, it reduces the measure of inflation being experienced by seniors.
So Social Security benefits aren't keeping up with costs. Again, Mary Johnson with the Senior Citizens League.
It means that their Social Security benefit can't buy as much today as it might have purchased 10 years ago.
A more accurate measure of inflation for seniors actually does exist. And sure enough, it is almost always higher than the one the Social Security Administration uses. This year, 1.9% versus 1.6%. But switching over would require an act of Congress. Dean Baker is at the Center for Economic and Policy Research.
Since you have a lot of people in Congress who aren't anxious to see us spend more on Social Security, they'd rather use the lower measure.
And given what is going on in Washington, this is kind of the last thing that Congress wants to be fighting about right now. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishour for Marketplace.
A brief trade interlude here, if I might. Very brief. Talks started again today in Washington. China's lead negotiator meets tomorrow with President Trump, whose tweet on the subject this morning read as follows. Big day of negotiations with China. They want to make a deal, but do I? Make of that what you will. This is an interesting week out here in California. Electricity, it seems, can no longer be taken for granted. Something like 800,000 households and businesses could be blackout for a day or days. There's a whole lot that's not quite certain about this. But the deal is that a number of months ago, regulators, lawmakers, and utilities agreed to what are being called public safety power shutoffs in areas where high fire conditions crop up. And that is happening this week. California had 6 of the 10 most destructive fires in its history in just the past 3 years. And while climate change is, yes, a catalyst, downed power lines or other electrical issues have sparked most of those fires. Pretty much everybody is unhappy with the shutdowns, but as Marketplace's Ben Bradford reports, they are a particular challenge for low-income households.
The lights are out in Sonoma County at an affordable housing complex managed by the local St. Vincent de Paul chapter. Executive Director Jack Tibbetts says some of the struggles facing his low-income tenants were eye-opening.
Those little things are just that much more difficult.
He describes a disabled former construction worker who struggles to move around his apartment.
He did not have a disaster preparedness kit. He didn't even have a flashlight to be able to see how to go from his bed to his bathroom.
And he couldn't have afforded them anyway. advocates say working families have their own challenges. Susan Cooper's nonprofit runs local Head Start programs, offering meals and education for more than 400 children.
We've had to close because most of them are located at schools, and the schools are closed. You know, so that kind of leaves our families with, if they work, they have to stay home.
But even moving up the income ladder, Marcy Roth at the Partnership for Inclusive Disaster Strategies says unplanned outages create financial stress.
The average family doesn't have an extra $400 for an emergency situation.
Like stockpiling food and medicine, or for people connected to medical devices, moving to another location. Roth says power shutoffs aren't as bad as wildfires or earthquakes, but they are, in a way, a kind of disaster.
Loss of power is something that emergency preparedness should be focusing heavily on.
One challenge for state and local emergency planners, federal aid is available for actual disasters, but not when utilities voluntarily shut off power to prevent them. I'm Ben Bradford from Marketplace.
Shares of General Motors jumped 1.5% today on news that CEO Mary Barra had a face-to-face meeting yesterday with union leadership. No reports of what the substance of that meeting might have been, but investors liked that it happened nonetheless. Same for the substance of the trade talks, actually. No sense of that, but investors like that they're talking. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Money can make things awkward, you know, talking about it, not having enough of it, having more of it than your friends or colleagues. It just gets sticky sometimes. So when you have a chance to get yourself a little bump, if you switch jobs, for instance, and you're negotiating your new salary, you got to take it, especially if you're a woman, given the realities of the gender pay gap. Rima Kreis, the host of our podcast, This is Uncomfortable, which is all about that idea of money making things weird, has this story of one woman's experience in pay negotiations.
About 3 years ago, Caitlin Boston decided she was going to ask her boss for a pay raise.
I knew I was really good at my job, you know, so I felt super prepared.
Caitlin had been working at this design agency in New York for 2 years in user experience research. She was pulling crazy hours and recently landed this massive $5 million project. But when she asked for a raise, her boss gave her this line.
I just don't think you have enough time on yet to really, you know, warrant this.
So then Caitlin did the thing almost all of us do when we're angry at work. She found her closest colleague and vented quietly.
So she was like, how did your conversation go? Are you okay? And I was like, I'm not okay. I'm really not okay. Does this look like I'm okay? Because I'm not okay.
Caitlin and a few of her coworkers decided to go out to eat that night. And over dinner, Caitlin asked them, hey, what do you all make? At the table were all women, and three of them, including Caitlin, had at least 7 years experience. One had a PhD under her belt. And then there was one woman who was fresh out of college. And it turns out they were all making the same amount of money. Caitlin was furious. She went home that night, and the gears in her head were turning.
I'm going to ask my male coworker tomorrow, who I'm close to, what he's making, because I just need to make sure. I just need to validate that we're all being screwed equally.
And as a person of color, Caitlin says it was especially important for her to ask a white male coworker. But when she pulled him aside the next day, he did not want to share how much he made. So then Caitlin said, if I give you a number, can you at least tell me if it's over or under that?
And I picked what I thought was a really egregiously high number. And he, you know, goes, oh, yeah, I'm making under that. And then I picked a number that was $10,000 less than that. And I said, oh, are you making over under this? And he goes, oh, I'm making over that. And when he said that, then, oh that's when just, oh, my hair went up and just like lit on flame.
He was making at least $20,000 more than her, even though they both had the same job background, same master's degree, and had been with the company for the same amount of time. That's when Caitlin realized she needed more data. So she cold messaged people on LinkedIn with similar backgrounds and positions, most of them white men, and she found out they were making about the same as what her male coworker was making, a comfortable six-figure salary.
I was in an echelon of salary potential that I had no idea was even possible.
She started applying to new jobs, and within a month, she had gotten four offers. She was most interested in an offer from Etsy. She remembers being on the phone negotiating her position.
When I offered the number, the recruiter just goes, I'm going to have to review this because this was a little bit higher than what we were expecting. And I was like, yeah, this is the minimum I'm going to come in for.
Caitlin and the HR guy go back and forth a couple of rounds. He's not able to match the salary she wants. So then Caitlin brings up the fact that her other job offers are able to match her desired salary.
And he was like, okay, let me see what I can do. And he came back and he said, well, okay, we're willing to offer you X, and I'm going to tell you that you're making more than X, Y, and Z people. And I'm like, okay. And I was like, can you do better? And he just goes, and that's when he told me, I can guarantee you are maxing out everything.
She took the job. And so what was the, like, percentage difference from your previous salary to what they were offering?
It was a 41% jump.
That's crazy.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
What?
It's life-changing money.
Okay, a 41% jump may not happen to all of us, but Caitlin says her experience can be useful to a lot of people outside of tech because what she's basically talking about is advocating for yourself. Employers, she says, need to be held responsible for helping to fix wage gap problems, but by not at least negotiating, you're just holding yourself back.
And if you're going to hold yourself back, particularly in your prime earning years, you're never going to be able to make that up.
So basically, she says, to get that money. I'm Marie Mechbais for Marketplace.
If what was missing in your life was a syndicated daytime talk show hosted by a movie star, well, today is your lucky day. Drew Barrymore, the aforementioned movie star, is headed to the small screen. She's going to host a new syndicated talk show for CBS next fall, the first new daytime show for CBS in years. And Barrymore's not the only one, personality-wise, getting in on the daytime TV scene. We've got new shows this year from Kelly Clarkson and Tamron Hall, Nick Cannon next year, Marketplace's Andy Euler has more on the economics of daytime talk and why networks are investing in it.
You remember Katie Couric's daytime talk show? Well, if you don't, that's probably why it flamed out after just 2 years. Ratings and production costs just didn't add up. Paige Albaniak at the trade publication Broadcasting and Cable says the batting average for these daytime talk shows is pretty low.
It's always a huge gamble. It barely ever hits.
NBC is betting Kelly Clarkson's star power from its hit primetime show The Voice will lead to daytime ratings.
Her deal is about being on The Voice and also being in daytime. So they can also sort of amortize the cost of Kelly Clarkson across the whole company.
That's one way of keeping costs under control, because the host's salary takes up a lot of the budget. Big ratings mean better rates for traditional ads, but product placement can also be a significant source of revenue for these shows. Crystal Russell teaches marketing at Pepperdine University. She says that kind of money only comes when a host really connects with the audience.
They are like thinking of them like they're real friends, and they really trust and rely on their judgment for anything that they talk about on the show, including perhaps brands that they might feature on the show.
She says that's why you might see Carnival Cruise Line prizes on Kelly Clarkson's show, or segments brought to you by Walgreens on Ellen. Elizabeth Wagmeister is a senior correspondent at Variety. She says the contentious political climate has helped cable news ratings, but is also boosting shows like Ellen.
People also need a bit of a break, and I think there's no better break than daytime TV.
But she says daytime talk shows have a short leash to prove their lasting power. Clarkson's show had the best debut in 7 years, right behind the premiere of Katie Couric's in 2012, which tells you a strong start doesn't necessarily mean everything. I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
Coming up.
The best thing that you can give them is like all the love that you have.
Life as a foster parent. But first, let's do the numbers. All right, here you go. Trade Talks is what this was. Dow Industrial's up 150 points, about a half percent, 26,496. The NASDAQ up 47 points, 6-tenths percent, 79.50. The S&P 500 gained 18 points, also 6-tenths percent, 29.38. Apple sweetened 1.3% today on higher demand for the new iPhone 11. Suppliers to that company also reaped the benefit. Chipmaker Skyworks Solutions climbed 5.1%. Semiconductor firm Qorvo grew 4.7% today. PG&E, of the aforementioned rolling blackouts, tumbled 29% as a judge opened the door to a rival bankruptcy plan to the one already in the works. More uncertainty for the troubled utility and its shareholders. Bonds fell. Yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 1.66%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Hey everyone, it's Rima Khreis, host of This Is Uncomfortable. If you're looking for some good recommendations on books to read, well, you should join This Is Uncomfortable's Summer Book Club. Every other week in our newsletter, we'll share a new book that'll make you rethink your relationship to money, class, and work, while also featuring an interview with the author or an expert on the topic. Plus, when you join, you'll be entered in a giveaway where you could win some This Is Uncomfortable merch. Be sure to check it out. Sign up today at marketplace.org/bookclub.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. The Air Transport Action Group, it's kind of an umbrella lobbying organization for commercial aviation and its related industries, says that by the year 2050, aviation carbon emissions will be half of what they were in 2005, which seems like a pretty heavy lift. So aviation is getting creative. At the airport in Rotterdam, the Netherlands, a group of companies is testing a new aircraft fuel using carbon dioxide extracted from air, which would cut a plane's carbon emissions to zero and in the process offer ecologically concerned passengers basically guilt-free flying. From the European desk, Marketplace's Stephen Beard has the story.
En het is natuurlijk wel lekker dat we nu gewoon kunnen praten, want hier hebben we toch geen...
Nou, weet ik eigenlijk niet, maar...
This really is a pilot project. This air crew about to take off from Rotterdam could soon be testing what consultant Willem van Genuten says is a revolutionary jet fuel.
We would like to kickstart a fundamental change in aviation. We want to facilitate synthetic fuel made from CO2 taken from air.
Van Genuten from a Dutch company called Urban Crossovers is part of a consortium testing the commercial viability of what is potentially an infinite source of low-carbon energy for aviation.
With the fuel made from air, you have a theoretical limitless amount of fuel available.
It's a kind of kerosene made from a mixture of carbon dioxide, water and electricity. So far, only small amounts have been created in a laboratory. The aim is to scale up production using the services of the Swiss environmental company Climeworks, which claims in a promotional video...
Climeworks is the worldwide first company that is commercially capturing CO2 from ambient air.
It's high-tech machines suck in the air and then filter out and collect the carbon dioxide, some of which will now be sent on to the Rotterdam project. Louisa Charles of Climeworks says using this to fuel aircraft will make a big difference to their emissions.
By using CO2 that's in the air already, we do not release additional CO2 in the atmosphere.
And, says Oscar Meyerink of Sky NRG, another company in the Rotterdam Consortium, there'll be no carbon emitted in the manufacture of the new fuel, so long as renewable energy sources of electricity are used.
If you produce the electricity in a sustainable manner, then the whole system can be carbon neutral.
He expects the new fuel will initially be much more expensive than fossil fuels, but...
We also expect that this cost can come down when the technology is further developed and we can scale up.
That could take 5 to 7 years, he says, but scaling up will be a major problem, claims one critic of the project. Jorien de Laker of Friends of the Earth in the Netherlands says the demonstration plant the consortium is building will only make 1,000 litres of the new fuel a day.
The 1,000 litres is about 5 minutes of flying in a jet.
If the new fuel is to replace fossil kerosene, she says, it'll require vast amounts of sustainable energy, given the current scale of global aviation.
We have 225,000 flights a day. This planet is not big enough to put all the extra wind and solar power in place to produce fuel for 225,000 flights a day.
Flying on air is not the solution, she says. The only feasible option is flying a lot less. But the Rotterdam Consortium claims we can fly guilt-free without causing climate change. Technology is advancing, and the whole business of carbon reduction is becoming more viable and more necessary by the day. At the European Desk, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Our podcast, The Uncertain Hour, has spent the past couple of years covering the opioid crisis and the effects it's having on communities and economies across the country. In West Virginia, it's become a social services crisis. That state has the highest rate of children in foster care anywhere, due in large part to opioids. And one of the key issues is that there aren't enough foster parents to go around. So today in the second of two stories, West Virginia Public Broadcasting's Roxy Todd looks at the challenges those parents and those families face.
Scott Tittle is cuddling with his two-year-old adopted son on the couch. Scott's wife, Donna, sits down next to them and holds up a red and blue light-up toy. She presses the buttons and music plays. The toddler's face erupts in a smile, listening. Scott and Donna took their son home as a foster baby when he was just a few weeks old. It's not exactly what they thought they'd be doing at this stage in life.
I mean, we're 48 years old. We're close to 50. You know, most of the people I work with are thinking about retirement and empty nest and traveling.
Their toddler is doing well now, but he has had some health issues and developmental delays because of opioids he was exposed to before he was born.
It's hard to forget what's happened to him and what didn't need to happen to him.
Initially, they didn't think they were ready to foster a child with a disability. But Donna says they quickly grew attached.
I could not give him away. There was just no way. He was a part of this family, and no matter what obstacles come through our way, he's ours.
But they needed to learn how best to take care of a baby with neonatal abstinence syndrome, or the physical effects babies experience during withdrawal from drugs. In their training to become foster parents, the Tittles say they didn't get any preparation for how to take care of a baby with NAS. Another foster mom, Kelly Crow, recalls a similar experience taking care of a baby girl with NAS. She remembers a lot of intense crying, which was scary. But ultimately, what the baby needed was pretty simple, around-the-clock cuddling.
The best thing that you can give them is like all the love that you have. So that means like physically, you know, all the touch that you can, all the soft voices that you can.
5 out of every 100 babies born in West Virginia have NAS. That's about 5 times the national rate. Many of these babies are put into foster care. Parents don't typically get any additional financial support unless the child's symptoms are severe or long-lasting. Marissa Sanders runs an advocacy group for foster families in West Virginia. She says those who need the most support are people who've taken in a grandchild or a neighbor, so-called kinship parents, representing about half of all foster homes.
Those people often don't get any training. They don't have the same level of support and, you know, background information and access to workers that a certified foster parent has.
Sanders wants the state to do more to help these grandparents learn how to cope with difficult behaviors.
When you're parenting a child who has experienced significant trauma, who is away from their birth family, who's, you know, in a difficult situation, there's a whole lot of extra support needed.
The state is trying to reduce the number of kids in foster care and save money. Jeremiah Samples is with the West Virginia Department of Health and Human Resources. He says the state needs to help more birth parents by connecting them with mental health care or parenting skills training. There are new funds available from the federal government to help. It's part of a new focus on keeping families together.
Once CPS goes out and a child has to be removed because of abuse and neglect, a trauma has already occurred. And so we need to prevent that to the extent that we possibly can.
Fewer kids having to face the trauma of being uprooted from their parents, their schools, and their communities is clearly a win for all. especially children. If, and this is a big if, the state and the federal government can find an effective way to help parents make changes in their lives so the kids are safe. In West Virginia, I'm Roxy Todd for Marketplace.
Final note on the way out today, a quick call back to the rolling electricity blackouts story we had up at the top of the program. Southern California Edison has some handy tips on its website should you be one of the unlucky ratepayers who's going to be without electricity at some point this week. Get cash because ATMs near your house aren't going to work. Make sure flashlights have batteries in them. Wrap your perishable foods in plastic wrap. The fridge should be cold enough for the first 48 hours. Those are the basics. Here's my favorite, though, and this is real. Learn how to open your garage door by hand. All right, we're going. The Dow Industrial's up 150 points today, about a half percent. The NASDAQ up 47.6 tenths percent. S&P 500 gained 18 points, also 6 tenths percent. Amir Bibawi, John Buckley, Eve Epstein, John Gordon, Heron Bikella are the Marketplace editing staff. Betsy Streisand is the managing editor. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
Hey everyone, it's Rima Jerez, host of This is Uncomfortable. If you're looking for some good recommendations on books to read, well, you should join This is Uncomfortable's Summer Book Club. Every other week in our newsletter, we'll share a new book that'll make you rethink your relationship to money, class, and work, while also featuring an interview with the author or an expert on the topic. Plus, when you join, you'll be entered in a giveaway where you could win some This is Uncomfortable merch. Be sure to check it out. Sign up today at marketplace.org/bookclub.